Welcome to In the Studio, with a 21st century perspective on history's greatest rock bands.
You're welcome.
Guitar up.
One, two, three.
I'm Redbeard, and today it's part one, the Woodstock Festival.
Give me an F! Give me a U! Give me a C!
I'm a farmer.
When we started listening to You, I Get the Music, it was dark. And I just kept playing it until the sun came up. I think we played it for 25 minutes, listening to You, I Get the Music. And the audience were starting to kind of get a bit fed up with it, I think. And then suddenly, the sun broke over the hill. I was kind of praying for it. And they just went berserk. The sun just went boing.
Tell them who we are.
It only added to the curiosity of our peers when we were at Woodstock, because until then no one had seen us, but they'd heard this fine piece of music, this album, and it was a hit, and people seemed to really love it, and no one had ever seen who Crosby, Stills and Nash was.
It's getting to the point where I'm no fun anymore.
We were doing quite well. A lot of people say Woodstock made the band, but we were doing good before Woodstock. We did the Woodstock Festival, and it wasn't until the movie came out that made all the difference. You know, if you do it, when you get onto celluloid, it makes things larger than life.
Hello, this is Pete Townsend in the studio.
Hi, I'm Marty Balin.
Hi, this is Grace Slick.
Hi, this is Paul Kantner from Jefferson Airplane, and you're in the studio.
Years after.
For a generation which famously, if not naively, once adopted the slogan, "Don't trust anybody over 30, it's with some trepidation that survivors of the Woodstock Nation approach the anniversary of the Woodstock Festival, which came to define it all. What happened over those 3.5 days on Max Yasgur's farm in upstate New York has been analyzed, in some ways mythologized, and now digitized in recordings and film in every possible manner. We've experienced echoes of the Woodstock Festival for 5 decades in everything from the way concerts were conducted, recorded, and filmed, to fashion, to politics, to urban highway planning. The Woodstock Music and Art Fair drew in 1969 more than 450,000 people to a pasture in Sullivan County, New York. The music began at 5:07 p.m. Friday, August 15th, and continued until mid-morning, Monday, August 18th. The festival closed the New York State Thruway and created one of the nation's worst traffic jams, inspiring a slew of local and state laws to ensure that nothing like it would ever happen again. As the festival's final night headliner, Jimi Hendrix recording engineer Eddie Kramer was brought up to Woodstock from Manhattan, where he was constructing Hendrix's Electric Lady Studios that year.
I was asked to join the film company up at Woodstock and record this festival. I think they picked me because I was in the middle of an album with Jimi Hendrix, and of course they thought that, well, you know, since Jimi is going to headline, you might as well get the guy who's working with Jimi and see if he wants to record the whole thing. And that was it. I don't think anybody knew it was going to be more than a gig. I think there was a sense, possibly, of something about to happen. If you look at the political climate, look at what has happened in America in that particular time. I mean, we're in the midst of the Vietnam War, lots of protests, you know, the hippie movement, the flower power, all that sort of thing. This was a sort of a gathering together and a celebration of that. And you kind of got a sense that, well, something's going to happen here. You know, Woodstock, let's get all the kids together and have a big concert. Well, you kind of knew by the names that were being bandied about that, well, this is going to be interesting. This is going to be fun. Might as well film it. Might as well record it. When I arrived there on that Friday morning at about 5:30 a.m. and saw the sun come up over an incompleted stage with the scaffolding still going up, and I thought, there's no bloody way in hell that this thing is going to work. And I realized by 12 noon that we still went on the air. And particularly when I walked out into the audience of about, must have been 200,000 by that point. That's my rough guess. And I went to where the PA was going to be operated from, and it was still being worked on. The console was up in the air. Smoke was pouring from it. Guys were soldering wires, and I thought, you know, there is just no way we're going to get on the air. But eventually we did, by 1 o'clock. I think Richie Havens opened up, as you well know.
The band Santana, at the time unknown outside their home of the Bay Area of Northern California, played Woodstock on day two and performed Soul Sacrifice. Influential concert promoter Bill Graham slipped them onto the bill, a career-breaking move, according to guitarist Carlos Santana.
It felt like we went from a high school aspiration dream to pretend that we knew we could play with Wes Montgomery, to Gabor Soul, to B.B. King, to all of a sudden being in the arena with these people, but instead of having your feet planted in the ground, you're hanging by your feet and somebody's twirling you around as fast as they can twirl you. I mean, that's what it felt like for me a couple of times, where I would go to my room after all that touring and the walls would never stop moving. I mean, and I haven't even taken anything. You know, and they're still doing that, but now I can control. I know where the door is and when to get out. You know, it's like getting out of a merry-go-round. You know, for me, it's been very different in a sense that ever since I crossed the border, life to a certain extent has been like a Disneyland. You know, in a positive sense, that, you know, you wish upon a star and all this kind of stuff. And I'm very grateful, man. Ever since I crossed the border, you know, in this country, there's a lot of things to do. But at the same time, you know, I have been giving a lot, and it hasn't stopped. In other words, it went really fast. It was dizzy. My head was spinning, and I'm sure it wasn't just my head alone that was spinning. You know, because nobody ever really could have trained us. To me, it would have been like trying to take a speedboat and try to climb Niagara Falls backwards. You just can't do it. It takes you. It overpowers you. It overpowered me. I'm sure it did. You know, and most of us, because it happened so fast and it was so much.
Santana drummer Michael Shreve.
We were on the road for a month or so prior to Woodstock. We were playing a lot of festivals and things like that that were going on at the time. There were a lot of, you know, groups that were traveling and playing these festivals like a bunch of gypsies. This was a big one coming up, and Bill Graham managed to get us on using his influence and talking people into giving us a shot, basically. I think we got paid $500 or something like that. The band was popular on the West Coast, and that was it, and we were just starting to play around the country and you know, get some more recognition. But Woodstock obviously broke it wide open. The thing I always feel about us at Woodstock was, it felt to me, and in retrospect as well as at the time, that one of the fortunate things about this band at Woodstock was that we really had each other. We never played to entertain an audience. In some ways, we were lucky to be not so professional, because we played to each other, and that was our strength. We had each other, you know, to play to, and you can see it now, and you can see it in Woodstock. We look at each other. We're not trying to project to the last person in the audience or something like that, you know, something that's trained in that sense. And I think we were as surprised as anybody that that playing, that interaction with each other on that stage, which was no different than we do anywhere else, did anywhere else at the time, projected in that sense.
Thank you. CT McGee, rather. Okay. Please come immediately to backstage right, which is over here. I understand your wife is having a baby. Congratulations. Could we continue, please?
An absolutely career-breaking performance of Soul Sacrifice at Woodstock in 1969 by Santana. The British band The Who had just released an epic double album, a rock opera, about a boy named Tommy, who was traumatized into sensory deprivation, becoming deaf, mute, and blind. Pete Townsend of The Who remembers performing Tommy at Woodstock.
And we had this incredible machine. I used to wake up on stage, you know, I kind of roll along to the gig, drive to the gig, tune up my guitar, stand on the stage and suddenly wake up, you know, as one leg of this crazed stallion leaping, marching through a field or, you know, like a Sherman tank or something. And it would be, you know, the feeling of power in the band at the time was just extraordinary. That was really all we had. That power had been rehearsed, practiced, refined on the road in America and around Europe and around the world, playing Tommy, bookending Tommy, you know, with rock and roll at the front and rock and roll at the end, and in the middle you get an opera. and God, we got good. We were really good. And we weren't good because we were rehearsed, you know, playing the notes in a particular order. We were good because we were instinctively in tune with one another, just through playing a lot. You know, any musician will tell you that this is a magical place to be, and we briefly were in that place. Started listening to You, I Get the Music, it was dark, and I just kept playing it until the sun came up. I think we played it for 25 minutes, listening to You, I Get the Music, and the audience were starting to kind of get a bit fed up with it, I think.
We forsake you, gonna rape you, let's forget you, better. Thank you.
And then suddenly the sun broke over the hill. I was kind of praying for it. And they just went berserk. The sun just went boing, tsh, you know. And then we played it for another 20 minutes. I remember John Entwistle being very pissed off that I'd kept it going for so long.
That was Pete Townsend, who at Woodstock rejected the blue denim hippie look by appearing on stage in a one-piece white jumpsuit with a laced-up jack boot, made then only in London by an orthopedic footwear doctor by the name of Martin. Next, Alvin Lee and Leo Lyons of 10 Years After decide there's no place like home, and Paul Kantner and the Jefferson Airplane do some volunteer work. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio on the fanniversary of Woodstock. Part 1.
Hi, this is Robbie Robertson.
Hi, this is David Crosby with Redbeard, the mighty beard.
Thank you, guys. You got to understand something about the Woodstock Festival. Concert staging, lighting, and sound was in its Jurassic period. And this wasn't the LA Forum or Madison Square Garden. This was Max Yezger's hog farm outside of Bethel, New York. Here's Woodstock Festival recording engineer Eddie Kramer.
It was a disaster right from the beginning in terms of the practical and technical aspects of things. They had built a circular stage, which was divided into a semicircle, i.e. the front half of the semicircle would be the first band, and the back half would be the second band, and the whole thing was on wheels. So you would pivot the whole thing and swing it around after the first band had finished. They did that for the first band, and all the wheels broke in the first turn. So that never happened. The communications between the truck, which is where I was in a tractor-trailer truck, in the back end of a tractor-trailer truck in a sort of a 10 by 10 area with two 8-track machines, both of which were in orange crates to support them, a 12-channel console with three Shure mixers, and virtually no communication with the stage. So it was done by hand signals and people running back and forth. It was kind of crazy. I just remember I ran out at one point to see the audience and to see what it looked like. I think this was late in the afternoon of the first day. And it was just a sea of people. By this point, of course, the fences had come down. We must have been 350,000, 400,000 people. And I was standing next to a gentleman who I had tremendous respect for, named Bill Graham. And he turned to me and said, "You know, Eddie, if these kids riot, we're dead." I said, "Thank you very much, Bill. I'm going back to my truck now."
Red dress on. I love my baby with red dress.
shake it all out, darling. I want to be half of you. I love you, baby. I got more than I do. I love you, baby. God knows I do. We're gonna shake it out. I'll be what I'm trying to do. Yeah. Woo! Oh, baby, I love that way you walk. Yeah. One more money. For the show, need to get ran on that go-cat, go-cat, go-cat. Give my blue suede shoe. Make it to the family of my blue suede shoe. Back that up, got a fried. Miss you by my bed at night. I got a cool man, be that shame to me. Knock down my fancy double beat to me. Yeah, coming on a baby, whole lot of shaking going on. Coming on a baby, whole lot of shaking going on. We're thinking, oh, that shit going on. Well, shake your baby, shake. But shake your baby, shake. Shake your baby, shake. Shake your baby, shake. Well, love it, babe. I love when walk to be gold. Oh, 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 yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, babe, I love that way you walk. Shoot you right now. Knock you off your feet. Whoa, baby. I got a crane.
We'll be right back.
10 years after bass player Leo Lyons follows singer, lead guitarist, the late Alvin Lee.
We were doing quite well. A lot of people say Woodstock made the band, but we were doing good before Woodstock. We did the Woodstock Festival, and it wasn't until the movie came out that made all the difference. You know, if you do it, when you get onto celluloid, it makes things larger than life. And the minute the movie came out, we went out of the 4,000 to 5,000 seater theatres and the kind of tea parties and those kind of gigs into the arenas. And a lot of people, as I say, they say Woodstock made 10 years after, but that's a fallacy. We were doing real good before then. It just kind of shifted us up a few notches.
It also opened up the small towns in between the big ones, I think, too.
It's true, but it's mainly down to luck. I mean, we just doing what we do best and rocking out. We didn't actually choose the song. I mean, we did an hour and a half set at Woodstock, and I've often wondered, had they picked a song like I Can't Keep From Crying and used that in the movie, it would have made a whole different perspective on the band. But I think from it being Going Home, it was a rock out boogie set. Rockers and people that like rock and roll music, they like to boogie down. It's unpretentious, it's straight ahead rock and roll. It just seemed to capture everybody. I think they just like the energy, and that's what it's always been about.
Like a true blues man, the late Alvin Lee of 10 years after left the Woodstock stage with a huge watermelon hoisted on one shoulder as a trophy from having rocked the tribe. The late Paul Kantner of the Jefferson Airplane in the studio talks about 1967's Summer of Love, which led up to Woodstock in August 1969.
Well, we had a good time during that period. I think a lot of it, the Summer of Love was overhyped a lot by a lot of Madison Avenue type stuff. So there is a natural lashback at that. But also I think there were people who, like people in the 30s, were pissed off at the 20s because everybody had such a good time and they weren't. That people are sort of pissed off at people getting away with what they did in the 60s that you can't get away with now. Be it sex, drugs, or all we have left is rock and roll, I think. Even mother's milk is dangerous these days. They tell us, if you believe them. You might have had a good time or a bad time in high school, but that was high school. And this is now. Enjoy your high school and take what you can from it that was good, and here you are now, and keep doing it if it works.
Look what's happening on the street. Got a revolution.
Got a revolution.
Hey, I'm dancing.
Jefferson Airplane live at Woodstock with Volunteers. Up next, Graham Nash with some of the biggest musical icons from Woodstock Festival. Crosby, Stills, and Nash will join us here in the studio. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, on Twitter at Redbeard Rocks, and online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio for the Woodstock Festival, Part 1. Welcome back in the studio for the Woodstock Festival. I'm Redbeard, and I know it's hard to imagine, but on August 17th, 1969, the band named Crosby, Stills, and Nash was practically unknown. The Woodstock Festival was only their second gig. What a coming out party, huh? Here's Graham Nash in the studio.
Strangely enough, in an era where music was basically giant stacks of Marshalls and feedbacks and loud electric guitars a la Hendrix, a la Led Zeppelin, a la Cream kind of thing, we made this kind of acoustic feeling album that just slipped right through all of it, right to the top of the charts. And it only added to the curiosity of our peers when we were at Woodstock, because until then, no one had seen us. But they'd heard this fine piece of music, this album, and it was a hit, and people seemed to really love it, and no one had ever seen who Crosby, Stills, and Nash was.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome with us Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young.
It's getting to the point where I'm no fun anymore. I'm sorry. Sometimes it hurts so badly I must cry out loud. I'm lonely, I am yours. You are mine, you are what you are.
You make it
hard.
A little less bottom end on the guitar, please.
Remember what we've said and done and felt about each other.
Oh, babe, have mercy.
Don't let the past remind us of what we are not now.
I'm not dreaming.
I am yours. You are mine. You are what you are.
You make it hard.
Tearing yourself away from me now. You are free
and I am crying. This does not mean I don't love you. I do, that's forever, baby. Yes, and for always.
I am yours, you are mine. You are what you are.
You make it hard.
Something inside is telling me that I've got your secret.
Are you still listening?
Fear is the lock and laughter the key to your heart.
Yes, and I love you.
I am yours. You are mine. You are what you are.
You make it
hard.
Hard. And you make it
hard.
And you make it hard.
Got to lose. Tuesday morning. Please be gone, I'm tired of you. What have you got to lose? Can I tell it like it is? Listen to the baby. It's my heart that's suffering tonight. That's what I want to do. I've got an answer. I'm going to fly away. What have I got to lose? Come see me Thursdays and Saturdays. Hey, what have you got to lose?
Thank you, we needed that.
This is our second gig.
This is the second time we've ever played in front of people, man. We're scared shitless.
Crosby, Stills, and Nash from the Woodstock Festival with Sweet Judy Blue Eyes. Join me with Woodstock Festival performers David Crosby, Graham Nash, Robbie Robertson of the band, Joe Cocker, and Marty Ballin of the Jefferson Airplane. For part two of the Woodstock Festival, I'm Redbeard. I'll be back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, inviting you to join us at the same day and time next week for part two of the Woodstock Festival. It was written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions. Copyright 2014, all rights reserved. Transcription by Jane Carpenter Brunet, theme song by Andy Timmons, and you can visit inthestudio.net for more.